Welcome, everyone, to a very exciting and special episode of Whisper in the Wings from Stage Whisper. We are being joined once again by the amazing playwright, Roger Q. Mason, who has such an exciting year ahead. They've got three incredible works being done across the country, starting with the world premiere of their new work, The Pride of Lions, playing March 28th through April 21st at the Theater Rhinoceros in San Francisco. Tickets and more information for that show are available at therhino.org. Then Roger's show Lavender Men is being done May 9th through June 8th at About Face Theater in Chicago. Tickets and more information for that show are available at aboutfacetheater.com. And then finally, they have another world premiere happening on June 7th through the 23rd at Philadelphia Theater Company called The Duet. You can get tickets and more information for this show by visiting philadelphiatheatercompany.org. We are so excited to welcome back our guests. We're so excited to learn more about these amazing works. So with that, let us go ahead and welcome on Roger Q. Mason. Welcome back to Whisper in the Wings from Stage Whisper.
Oh, thank you so much, Andrew, for having me. It's a great pleasure to be on the show and to join your listeners again. You have a loyal and beautiful following, and I just love engaging with you and them on this show.
Oh, thank you so much for that. It is always such an honor to have you here. And with new works, I'm so excited about this. For anyone who doesn't follow Roger or hasn't seen any of their work, it is absolutely amazing. The reading we got to see last year at 5959 was truly fantastic. So this made my heart so happy to see so many productions of your work happening across the country.
Yes.
And I kind of want to start by giving our listeners a little bit of a refresher and an introduction to your work. So do you mind telling us a little bit about what each of these plays are about?
Well, yes. First of all, the season, what Emily Owens, my dear publicist, and I are calling the season of Miss Mason, you know, it's sort of a debut season for me in many ways, because this is the first time I've had this magnitude of work done on a national forum, and different kinds of plays too, all different kinds of companies working on them. So it's allowing me to take a tour of the theater in America as it manifests, as well as to tour my plays and share that work with America. The first play that you mentioned is The Pride of Lions. And this piece is going up in San Francisco at Theater Rhinoceros. It is the longest running LGBT theater in the globe. They purport to be the most continuously run theater that does queer work anywhere in the world. So it's quite a stupendous feat to be doing that kind of work and sustaining it through all of the political and social and, you know, legal changes that have challenged work of LGBTQ theme over the years. And this company has persevered. The Pride of Lions takes place in 1928 New York, and it imagines five female impersonators who are in a play by Mae West called The Pleasure Man. And the show gets shut down by the vice police, because of course this is the Prohibition era, and they have to spend an evening in jail. And for better or worse, they have a very prying-eyed warden who wants to see them perform for him in jail in exchange for getting out. And of course the consequences if they don't please him are quite dire. So this is sort of their cabaret in the jail for this gentleman who is a little too curious about their lives. And I started writing this play in 2014 while I was living in Chicago. It was a beautiful time because I encountered a lot of folks who were gender expansive and transgender during my time there. And I realized that I was not of the binary at that time. I remember seeing my first gender nonconforming bathroom and saying, oh, this is where I'm supposed to go. And suddenly 30 some years of shame and confusion about my place in the world were dispelled by finding my pisser. And it was such a really simple gesture, but also a really tragic one, that I existed before this in a world that had no space for me. And so I was inspired by my own transformation and the things I had learned from these artists and these folks. And I wrote this play. It has had a couple of readings. It did a reading at Dixon Place during the pandemic, and also Theater Rhino did a showing of an excerpt of it also in the pandemic. And on the strength of those two showings, Rhino was able to get an NEA grant, as well as another grant from an organization in the Bay Area. And so we are a nationally funded and authorized expression of art. I want to let you know, you know, and just thinking about the troubled history of queer folks making work within the constructs of the NEA, this is a great triumph for me on a national scale. You know, for the history of the NEA 5 and sort of the conservative politics around national funding is a dulled memory. But for me, it remains very, very present. So I personally do not take lightly the fact that I have a show about folks who are genderqueer and female impersonators taking place 100 years ago, discussing struggles that we still are having today about queer rights, and that show is funded in part by our nation's institution for funding of the arts. So if there's any way to, and that it's going up in San Francisco, which is a town that has always been at the forefront of fighting for the rights of queer folks. And so it's really, for me, the right way to start this season. So that's Pride of Lions, Theater Rhino. You mentioned the dates there, March and April. Then we go to Chicago and my play Lavender Men. So for, in many ways, that's a homecoming, because I started that play after a trip to Springfield, Illinois, and then to Chicago. I had gone to the TCG conference. This was around 2012 or 13. And I went to Springfield, Illinois, to the Lincoln Museum just after Kushner's movie. And so they still had all the books out from all the folks that were researching Lincoln lore during that time. So they didn't have to search for. And, you know, this is my piece about Abe Lincoln and his legal assistant, Elmer Ellsworth, who have a queer love affair right before his first election. And it's really, you know, that play you've covered, and I've been very humbled that the country has taken notice of it. And of course, the first production of that piece was at Skylight Theater in Los Angeles in 2022. So to now see that it has legs and that it's starting its life as a regionally produced piece, you know, of course, with leanings and desires to be seen in New York, ultimately. Hello, New York. Come on, let's do it. You know, this is the first step in a long life that I am praying this piece will have. So I sort of have my champagne bottle and I'm standing on the dock christening this piece's national life. It's being directed by, oh, I should mention, The Pride of Lions is being directed by Eli Orkiza, who is a tremendous, tremendous talent in the Bay Area. And Lavender Men in Chicago is being directed by Lucky Stiff, one of the most innovative and exciting directors making work between Chicago and now New York that I've seen. Lucky and I went to graduate school together at Northwestern. And they were really one of the inspirations behind both of those plays, Pride of Lions and Lavender Men. So to reunite with Lucky as a collaborator, as a friend, was such a thrill for me. I trust them completely. Lucky has such a brilliant eye for creating events. So I'm happily deploying that piece and being very hands off with it. I don't need to do anything because they've got a beautiful design team on it. And Lucky's such an ace director that I'm not even worried about it. I'm actually excited to be objective and come in as an audience member and see what they did. Because of course, folks that have been following this story know that I played the role of Taffeta, the narrator of this love affair, in the first production. So I'm happy to turn the heels over to the next girl because mama needs a break and I need to do my stretches. I'm still doing my stretches from the last production. So I'm happy for someone else to do it. You know, you can go ahead, honey. Go ahead and have it for now, you know. And so that's Lavender Men in Chicago in May entirely June. And then we go to the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia. And Philadelphia is getting to see my play, The Duet, which is a solo show about a gentleman who was a member of the Black Power movement, who feels that he was estranged from his people. And so he defects and he becomes an FBI informant. And sort of helps to dismantle the local chapter of the movement in Los Angeles. It's based on some real events, sort of ripped from the headlines of a few things that happened during the civil rights into the Black Power movement era in LA. And we've written a solo show about one man's search for family and identity and community, his cry for community. And what's really exciting about this show, it's directed by Tabi Magar, who is the co-artistic director of Philadelphia Theater Company. It's her first season. So another christening, you know, we're sort of on her maiden voyage. And also it's my regional theater debut. That's right. That's right. I'm getting the Lort Treatment League of Regional Theaters. And it feels good to be in the big leagues, darling. It feels great. I understand why the girls stand in line to get those shows at the Lort Theaters because they really do take care of you and it's wonderful. So I'm really happy to be introducing that play and more importantly, my work to our larger institutions because it's a signal that I'm ready for them and they better get ready for me. So that's sort of the significance of that. Also, you know, The Duet started as a show that I wrote. I started about 2015, 16. There was a woman named Maisha Nguyen, who I studied with through Middlebury College, who it piqued my interest in literacy and learning in the Black Power movement. She was trying to humanize these folks who have been criminalized by popular culture up till that point that, oh, they were radical and this and that. No, she's saying they were interested in educating people and giving them home. And so that idea became very exciting as a source of drama for me. So that's where it started. We did a showing of it, a different version of it with my dear friend Lovell Holder at Sun Assembly Theater back in, I'd say about 2016 or 17. Then it sat on the shelf for a while. And during the pandemic, there was all this interest in sort of documenting my work. And I said, well, what's wrong with me? Am I dying? But, you know, it was a very uncertain time because we were all trying to preserve each other because people didn't know what was happening. So I met Tabi and we got a chance to do one showing of it with Wayne Brady. Yeah. And that kind of set us on a trajectory with that piece. Because we did that with the Fire This Time Festival with Wayne. And then after that, we did one with Greg T. Daniel, who's the artistic director of Lower Depth Theater in Los Angeles and also was on Insecure, the television show, amongst other things. And that was with Center Theater Group. And then Tabi was announced as the artistic director of Philadelphia Theater Company and said, why don't you come on with me? And I have to tell you something, Andrew. loyalty is a powerful tribute and a beautiful tool and really a humbling gesture in our business. When someone follows through on a promise and says, wherever I go, you're coming with me. As a theater artist, particularly as a playwright, you never forget that. So it really meant a lot to me that Tabby and her husband, Tyler, in their inaugural season, said, I got a home now, and I got a bedroom for you. Why don't you come on? You don't need to just bring your toothbrush. We'll provide the rest. That meant the world to me. And especially when we were first talking about it 2 years ago, we were still locked down, didn't know what was happening. To know that I had a place to land and that I had a home and that I would have a future in this business was encouraging. It gave me hope and it gave me strength to keep writing in those dark and uncertain times. So for me, that production is special because it's also a tribute to two artists' commitment to another artist and the mutual bond that we have towards changing with the platform we have at this regional theater, changing the voice and the face of the American theater at large.
That is all amazing. Amazing. I am so excited for all this work. All three cities, fabulously lucky to have you. And it's about time the Lord got on board with your work. I love that. Get ready to hear you come. Yes, absolutely. This is the perfect intro right there to the work being done across the country. This is exciting.
Yes.
So I want to turn a little bit more to these two world premieres, the Pride of Lions and the Duel.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know. I mean, we are quite a bit away from them going up, but still, what has it been like developing these works?
Yeah. So I'll start with the Pride of Lions. You know, a lot of the development work for the Pride of Lions happened about 2 years ago. And so I was set up for success in that we had much of the script-based development done. We knew who these characters were. We knew what the story was going to be. And so what this has been an exercise in is how do you adapt it to a space? So Theater Rhino has a unique setup. They have essentially a converted art gallery or sort of gallery of some kind that has, I would say, under 50 seats. So it's a cabaret house, really, which works for this piece because especially in the second act, which is the performance and the sort of the show and tell for this warden, there's a kind of intimacy that makes the work sing that if it was a large room, you would need to recalibrate. I'm not saying it wouldn't work. You just need to recalibrate it. So this opportunity is about adaptation and immersion. What little gestures in the script do I need to really draw people right up to the eyebrows and the nose of these stories? And that's been a process. We did a workshop of it last year in San Francisco and learned a lot about the play and how it functions. And for me, it was also about learning the city, because I'm a new writer to that town. So I'm learning what the audience culture is, what the performance culture is, what the actors are like. And that's also been part of development. Because as I'm now going into working side by side with the producers and the creative team, I'm also introducing myself to this city as a new artist. And that's part of the work too, you know? That's also true in Philadelphia. Now, the Philadelphia situation is exciting in that I said to the marketing, but you're gonna sort of be a fly on the wall in the marketing conversation. I said, look, in terms of audience development, we have three goals here. We've gotta introduce me to the city of Philadelphia. We've got to introduce this play to the audiences of this theater, audiences of previous times and new ones that you might be developing. And then we've got to introduce this alliance between the artistic directorship and me in mutual agreement that this is the right time, place, and moment to do this play, and that we're inviting this audience to build it with us. And all of those things and the rigor of that rhetoric are necessary to manage the expectations and prime the audience to receive the work. Now, that's happening. And while that's happening, I'm also expanding the piece. So we did two big workshops of it and one showing. And of course, I love to, I use that little weight loss app called Noom, and they have a term on there called habit bundling. It basically means mutually beneficial multitasking, because, you know, not all multitasking is beneficial. But when you do several things that achieve a couple of goals that are positive, it's called habit bundling. So I like to habit bundle. So I, when I did that workshop, I said, well, number one, we're getting this play, moving the script forward. But number two, when we do the showing, we're doing a TED Talk, because I need to get out here and do this dog and pony show and get these folks excited. And I knew we'd have a captive audience because, you know, it was a lot of people, they said, were coming. And so I knew that those two things were both needing to happen that week. And we were successful and I was very happy. You know, Philadelphia is a very testing town. It's sort of like being an amateur night at the Apollo. If they like you, they'll let you know and you'll be able to play tomorrow night. If they don't, pack your bags, because it's over. And so there was a lot riding on that showing that we did of the excerpt. And I think we were successful because we endeared ourselves to that subset of folks that would come to the show. And I've even gotten a couple of people to write back and say, oh, we're looking forward to June and really excited for you. So I think it was exactly what it needed to be. On the script side of things for the duet, the original version was about 40 minutes because we were writing it in the pandemic as a digital piece. So now we've doubled the length of it. And what we've done is we've added a character in the drum. The drum is now a talking drum. So he's sort of like a sidekick to this soloist who is going through the Egyptian afterlife. I forgot to mention earlier that the piece takes place in this person's afterlife experience. They're dead now and are now their soul is being judged in the Egyptian afterlife. And so there's this drummer that is sort of guiding them through, but can't speak. So he has to speak through the drum. So we add a little obstacle along. So we've been developing that. So it feels kind of like, I think it's Star Wars. You know, I don't watch science fiction that much. R2-D2, I think it is, the one that goes beep, boop, boop, beep, boop, boop. That, is that the one? You're nodding. That's the one. Yeah, it's like that. You know? And I've had fun doing that. It's been a blast, you know, developing that character and also the dynamic between them, because it sort of becomes like many comedic duos that we would see on classic television, you know, sort of an Abbott and Costello type thing, you know. So it's interesting to do that. And that's been the development of those two world premieres primarily.
That is so exciting. I love that. And particularly the duet. I mean, what an incredible obstacle, but it'll be great to see in the drummer. You know, that would be amazing. I mean, you don't need a common language to communicate.
Right.
You know? Just body language is a perfect language to get through. So this will be really exciting to see. And I love the fact that the way that you're expressing the soul being judged in the afterlife. It's not the traditional way that we know here in the Western world about your soul being judged. So this is really exciting. All these new ideas that you're presenting to an audience is fabulous.
Every play is like a new athletic exercise for me. Every play I do, I try and explore a different method of storytelling, a different style of writing, or a different sort of aesthetic choice that expands my toolbox and also challenges my worldview, so that I'm never settled, you know, and complacent in who I am or what I've become. I always want to be learning something and becoming somebody new. And I look at these shows as an invitation to experiment and to learn and to grow. So I really love that the chance that we get as writers to never stop learning and to always be in the classroom. And, you know, fortunately for us, the classroom is the world, you know?
Yeah, that's so well put. I love that. I kind of want to snowball a little off of this. And I'm curious, yeah, to know, because I mean, we've got these three great shows, somewhat similar, but very much different.
Right.
Is there a message or a thought you are hoping the audiences take away from these works, either individually or as a whole?
Well, you know, what you're asking about is my mission as a writer, really. And that's a question that writers have to answer all the time when we're applying for grants. And I always keep my mission statement fresh because I evolve and I think my mission evolves. And what I've realized about the trends in my work thematically is that they are all freedom songs. The ones that I'm writing, especially now, they are works of art, freedom songs that are being performed in the pursuit of a liberation of a people. Not always the same people, but folks who exist outside of the established norm, who deserve a place of complexity and dignity and grace in our natural world, and are not always afforded it by their colleagues, their human colleagues. And so what my work seeks to do is to sing into existence a new world in which they can be their fully realized and liberated selves. And through the performance of this work, I imagine the possibility of such liberation. And if we can do that in a play, it is evidence that we're capable of doing it in life if we come together with that shared purpose.
I love that. What a profound thought to have and to be sharing, and especially across this body of work. I think from what I have heard and what I've seen, it definitely shines through. So that's brilliantly put. My final question for this first part of the interview is, who do you hope have access to The Pride of Lions, Lavender Men, and The Duat?
I'm really, you know, one of the things about developing productions at this scale is that you have to be very local and you have to be really cognizant of each city and each audience and each market. So I'm learning what each of these markets is. You know, San Francisco, the most obvious choice for San Francisco is, I would love for this play to reach younger queer audiences who may not know this history. But I also think it's important for their allies and also their contrarians to hear this story. Folks whose minds can be changed by a story about the struggles of queer folks outside of their lived experience. So that's something that I'm excited to explore with marketing, to see who are those demographics and how do we reach them in San Francisco. Now, by and large, San Francisco as a whole is a fairly liberal leaning town. So there's a certain level of camaraderie and commonality that folks will feel towards the message of the piece. But I'm always excited when someone outside of that lived experience says, I saw myself in that too. It may not have been me specifically, but I knew that I've felt that before, I've seen that. Chicago has its own audience. I mean, that show, I think, is gonna, Lavender Men, is gonna really reach a wide range of folks. I know that About Face has a loyal following of queer folks and their allies that are watching those shows. But I also think the aesthetic of that show, you know, it involves movement and dance. There's going to be a sort of visual art or aesthetic element to it. that Lucky Stiff is going to bring. I think that folks from sort of the immersive theater scene and the sort of cabaret and the nightlife scene are also going to come to that show that in ways that are exciting to me, because those were the people I wanted to be when I was in Chicago. I loved watching those performance art folks. And of course, I think history buffs and Lincoln fans are going to come out because of the intrigue of the subject matter. But the most important folks that I'd like to see at that show are folks like me, plus size folks who don't always feel seen and appreciated. I want them to leave that show knowing that they have a place in this world and that they are beautiful and treasured exactly how they are. You know, my own journey to understanding that is not finished, you know, and to get to a place where I could even identify those emotions has been quite an arduous journey. So whenever that piece is read or shown, and somebody who looks like me, who shares some aspect of my own experience with my own body and my own desire for intimacy and care and softness and grace, whenever somebody sees that show and says, "You sang my song," that's when I know it's worked. And that's who I hope comes to see that. Philadelphia with the doo-wop is, I mean, everybody needs to come because they got a whole lot of seats to fill. You know, I grew up in the First African Methodist Episcopal Church. And of course, First AME started in Philadelphia. And the history of Black organizing through social and religious groups is a significant part of Philadelphia's history as well as my history in Los Angeles. I'm excited to introduce my work and myself to Philadelphians, Black Philadelphians. I'm really, especially intergenerationally, because this is folks' grandparents or their parents' generation. And then now we have young audiences who are in a new social revolution, who are looking for really guides and mentors from the past of how we can survive the present to get to the future. So this particular piece, I think, paints a vision of the struggle for humanity and for our rights, not only nationally, but also within the community. Now, the other thing is that this actor that plays this part has there's an element of dance involved. And we have the wonderful Dr. Tonde Whitney on this, working professor at Temple. And that I'm really excited for folks to see Dr. Tonde's work. So to me, the dance community, and then of course the music community, because I believe the drummer that we're going to work with is quite a prominent figure in the instrumental world in Philadelphia. So I think those worlds are going to collide in an exciting way. And, you know, as a whole, I would say I'm excited for folks to see these works as a reflection of who we are as a country right now, and a prayer for who we can become once we find community and camaraderie and common well-being.
Second part of our interview, as our listeners know, we love to get to know our guests a little bit better. And this is the third time that we've gotten to have you on our show. I feel like we're Facebook friends, if you will, you know,
Yeah,
we've gone past
I'm
that.
curious what you're going to ask this time, because I don't remember. The good thing about me is my short-term memory is not always so good. So I don't remember what I said to you last time or the other time. So it'll be a new answer today.
Well, we've gotten to talk to you about your inspirations, and we've gotten to talk to you about how you got into the arts. And I want to build on all of that because, with the works that you have created and that are being done of yours, And along with a lot of the messaging that you're hoping will come through, I want to know what changes would you like to see in the theater?
Well, I think I'm part of a movement that's making them right now. You know, we're in a labor revolution. I'm a very prominent member of the Dramatists Guild. Work with a lot of committees at the Guild that are centered on the rights of playwrights to advocate for themselves and their work. So one of the major changes that I'd like to see is a national recognition that a playwright's work is not done once they've submitted the license for a show, that we are working when we're in rehearsal, and that our license to do the show is not the same as a remuneration or an acknowledgement of the creative and tangible labor that we're doing in the room. So there's this term playwright stipend that is going around, and some theaters are offering it and others are not, and others are sort of saying, well, go ask the other guy. I would like us as a country to acknowledge financially that we are just as deserving of a rate in the room that acknowledges the contributions that we make. Because as I have said time and time again, more often than not, you know, opportunity is waged as currency in our business. And unfortunately, I can't go to the bank and cash opportunity. Now I can turn my opportunity into something, and that goes into self-determination and the transcendental movement and Thoreau and all of that, you know. Good old, I went into the woods, you know, stuff. But that's not the real life reality of where we are. I mean, we got to eat too. And look, theaters do what they can. Theaters do what they can with the resources that they have. And I really do believe that most theaters are well-meaning. Certainly, I don't work with any theaters that are not well-meaning. So you can look to my list on my resume as places that are going to treat you right. You know, all of these theaters, you know, Rhinoceros, About Face, Philadelphia Theater Company, are all really centered on making sure that artists feel happy and welcome and supported. And in the varying ways that they can, based on the resources that they have. And many theaters, most theaters are still doing that. A lot, some theaters live in a place of scarcity, you know, and some people live in a place of scarcity. That's don't blame it on the theaters. The theater is just a building. The people bring their values into the room. And I think we've really just got to start mirroring back to people what we want to see, you know, treat people as you want to be treated. How do we create a culture where folks feel acknowledged to do their best work? So I would like to see playwright stipends be instituted, especially in the world premieres, especially in the world premieres, because we are working. We are there. We even when the script is locked and we're giving suggestions, I always make sure to couch my suggestions in. From the script's perspective, here's the question I have, so that way I don't step on anybody else's departmental toes. But I think writers need to think that way too. The other thing that I would like to see changed, if anything, is the relationship to development into production. Now, we're starting to see a lot of this, and I've now gotten a chance to do a couple of these fancy reading festivals. And what I can say is that I think theaters are really trying to do a good job of getting people out of what they call developmental reading hell. They're either taking the plays or they're, you know, they're sort of passing on them or taking them, and they're being much swifter and more transparent and a lot more efficient about it. And I think that's because the leaders is these young folks at our age that are saying, look, I don't have time to sit here and wait, neither should you. So I can't do it. Here's why. Or come on, here's what I can do. And I really like that. And I'd like us to continue being that transparent and efficient. You know, I'm noticing a trend in young artistic directors. The secrets aren't there. The court intrigue is falling away. Now, listen, there's certain proprietary information that we can't know, and probably I don't want to know. But for the things that we can know that are useful, let us know, because then that gives us a more transparent conversation about where we are and where we're going. And I really like that that's a trend that we're moving towards. And then the last thing that I'm excited to see us continue doing is making space for queer and trans stories of the global majority. You know, I'm working on this piece right now, The Pride Alliance, and we had to rewrite a part, actually. So I am working quite actively on this production, because it was amazing how a particular subset of the T and the G aspect of LGBTQ were not present for these auditions, and not present because maybe they didn't have the opportunities beforehand, or the confidence in coming to audition. So we've got to start folks somewhere. We've got to start writing works that give these people a chance to ply their craft and develop their skills. And so that's really what I'm excited for, is a world in which we're writing with more abundance trans and gender nonconforming stories of the global majority, so that these folks, both on the stage and off the stage as designers, have a chance to work.
That is wonderful. And I'm with you 100% on that. And I hope that these changes come soon.
And here's the thing. We are the change. You know, so look, I'm a dog when contract time comes. Nobody wants to talk to me during contract time, because I will ask all the questions. But I'm not, but here's what I want artistic directors to know. I'm not just asking them for me. I'm asking them for the children to come. And if I have to seem pushy or overly overzealous or whatever, so that I can help build a precedent for the next generation, then beat on me. Mother can take it, because I'll go to the spa afterwards and sweat that shit out, you know. But I really know. And I, whenever I go into negotiation, I know that I'm setting a precedent, because that is a document. Because you see, the Dramatists Guild has set contracts for Broadway and off-Broadway productions. And I think we're working on stuff with regionals. But once you start getting out in the field, it's sort of every person for themselves. And every time it's a new contract. So we're kind of reinventing the wheel. Now, there are certain things that are given or expected and are honored. No, I'm telling the children how the field is, because not many folks want to say it. But every time you get up to a production, you know, in the theater in America, you're kind of reinventing the contract, and you have to really advocate for yourself. So I know that even if I'm working, you know, on a cabaret show or whatever, I'm setting a precedent through that document that somebody else can point to and say, well, this is what happened that time. And I'd like to see how close we can get to that. You know, and for me, there's absolutely no malicious intent, none. And look, all the artistic directors that I've worked with, they all know that. They're trying to figure out how they can make the money work to do the show in its best way with the resources they have. And I'm trying to make sure that the work of the writer is not forsaken in that. And I think what I've been happy with in my negotiations till now is that folks have either already come to the table with that mutual understanding, or they've been willing to learn from empirical evidence what those needs are, those access needs, and they've been able to say, okay, let me see what I can do to help you. And in doing that, we the artistic directors of American theater and the play and the Roger Q. Mason Freedom Song. We have made a contribution towards the liberation of the American playwright by setting forth contracts that fairly and equitably and generously acknowledge at every level, from small to regional. You know, I've made sure in my work that I've left a paper trail that can help the next generation. And I want these artistic directors to know that they have contributed to that betterment, and that I'm grateful to them for going along with it, and that the generation that they're building towards with me, the kids that are coming to these shows and saying, I want to be like that next, they're going to be grateful for this too. So sometimes we all are looking at this from a selfless place. We're doing things not just for us, we really are doing them for the ages and for the future. And that's how I see these negotiations. I really do believe in the noble dedication to leaving a paper trail that will allow the next generation to have it a little bit easier than how you had it.
Yes. Amen. Say that again for the people in the back. Absolutely. And I love that word you brought up, precedent. I think right. That's definitely the attitude of people our age, of our generation. Is it's not just about us, it's about going forward, which is a beautiful thought. Yes.
Absolutely.
Well, as we wrap things up here, I just want to slip in two more questions. One of which is, do you have any other projects or productions coming on the pipeline that we might be able to plug?
Yes. I don't know the dates for this, but I have a commission with Center Theater Group. Again, very happy to be working with them again. And I'm writing a piece about Bayard Rustin's early years. I know that there's a movie out, and I'm talking vaguely about it because I haven't seen it, because I'm working on Rustin right now. So I don't like to be influenced until I found my way. But I'm writing a piece about his early years as a young man of libertine leanings in Harlem and in the 20s and the early 30s. And there's going to be a reading of that in June in Los Angeles at the Kirk Douglas Theater. So look out for that. The dates have not been determined. And a sort of upcoming attractions later next year, I am working and I'm in the early stages of a production of The Pink, which you saw, that'll be in 2025. And I'm also in sort of early conversations about dates for another play of mine called California Story. And that'll also be in 2025. So those are two that I know about. And then, you know, we'll see where things go. So this year, we'll get to June. I'll do all this stuff around the country. I'll come back home to LA. And then I think I'll take a nap in the fall. And then I'll be back up in January 2025. Getting started again, but that's how it's looking right now.
That is amazing. I love how many irons are in the fire for you. This is incredible. All the success you're getting, absolutely wonderful. And it leads to my final question, which is, if our listeners would like more information about any of your shows, the Pride of Lions, Lavender Men, or the Duat, or about you, maybe they'd like to reach out to you, how can they do so?
The very best way to reach me is on my Instagram, and the Instagram handle is at rogerq.mason, at rogerq, my middle name is Quincy, so that's a Q for Quincy, .mason, and you'll find all kinds of information on there about the shows, and also I have a cooking show that I do on there called Cooking with Q, and we're in our second season, we're doing Filipino dishes inspired by my mother. So the last one was such a hoot that I thought I'd do another one. And then there'll be a couple more seasons to come out this year. So that there's a lot of fun on there. And I hope people can enjoy it. Instagram at rogerq.mason is the best way to reach me.
Wonderful. Well, Roger, thank you as always for taking the time to speak with us today. Thank you for sharing the incredible works that you're doing and just all the great things that you continue to do, both on and off the stage. I really appreciate your time. This is always so wonderful to speak with you. So thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much. It's a great honor and a pleasure to be on the show with you, Andrew. And, you know, your listeners are such loyal devotees and developers of new work in the American theater. So to speak to them and share some of my tricks of the trade is a great honor. And thank you for having me.
Thank you. My guest today has been the amazing playwright, Roger Q. Mason, who we always love to have here. And they have three great shows happening this spring and summer, starting with the world premiere of The Pride of Lions, March 28th through April 21st at Theater Rhinoceros in San Francisco. Tickets and more information for that show are available at therhino.org. Then in Chicago, May 9th through June 8th at About Face Theater, you can catch Lavender Men. And tickets and more information for that show are available at aboutfacetheater.com. And finally, as we head into the summer, a world premiere of Roger's new show, The Duet, is playing June 7th through the 23rd at Philadelphia Theater Company. And tickets and more information are available at philadelphiatheatercompany.org. This is an amazing collection of work. If you're looking for a great road trip, start on the West Coast, make your way east. These are wonderful shows. And if you'd like to see more about what Roger is doing, has coming up, and all the amazing other stuff that they have, check out their Instagram at rogerq.mason. In the meantime, get your tickets for any one of these amazing shows, The Pride of Lions, Lavender Men, and The Duet. So until next time, I'm Andrew Cortez, reminding you to turn off your cell phones, unwrap your candies, and keep talking about the theater.
In a stage whisper.
Thank you.
If you like what you hear, please leave a 5-star review, like, and subscribe.
You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Stage Whisper Pod.
And feel free to reach out to us with your comments and personal stories at stagewhisperpod@gmail.com.
And be sure to check out our website for all things Stage Whisper and theater. You'll be able to find merchandise, tours, tickets, and more. Simply visit stagewhisperpod.com. Our theme song is Maniac by Jazzar. Other music on this episode provided by Jazzar and Billy Murray. You can also become a patron of our show by logging on to patreon.com/stagewhisperpod. There you will find all the information about our backstage pass as well as our tip jar. Thank you so much for your generosity. We could not do this show without you.